The decision to terminate a future life member cannot be taken lightly, for its influence on the dismissed is only part of its overall integrated impact. Family upheaval, company and community upheaval, when it is the result of the unnecessary action of the bosses, is an especially serious matter. But because he was first and foremost a family man, he was obliged to act to whatever degree was provided under the law to protect his family and its established connections to the company and the surrounding community. The appeal was therefore a matter of brute survival, as well as one of maintaining basic humanity and personal integrity. In this case, there would be no room for a facile response to an unwarranted dismissal. He could not silently walk away from his staff and colleagues, from the many years of intense commitment, and from the material needs of his family. And now, so he said, he deeply appreciated the opportunity to defend himself, his family, his colleagues, and the principles of fair play and integrity before the appeal committee, even if it had been selected, save one member, by the bosses themselves. Fat chance. In the presentation to the appeal committee, he would elaborate on the materials already presented in the appeal document, which had already been presented just before Christmas. As he believed procedural errors related to the appeal had been sufficiently covered in this document, he would only mention them briefly, focusing later on the substantive problems, followed by a reference to the Innovation Discrimination Employment Act, that is, if he could hold on and keep a straight face. Dressed in his power clothing, he went on to carefully explain that 6 years earlier, the company had appointed him to a future life position as coordinator of research, not too much innovation, please. As this was a regular future life membership appointment, his position had been subject to regulations presented in the company employee handbook, which stated, every future life member who has yet to be awarded life membership must submit an annual report to the appropriate department committee at a time and in the form to be set by that committee. Furthermore, and in the same regard, the life member policies and procedures state that a future life member who has yet to be awarded life membership must submit an annual report to the policies and procedures committee, utilizing the proper format at date and time to be set by that committee. While he had followed all of these guidelines since the onset of his future life appointment, materials had been suddenly and unexpectedly withdrawn in November from submission by a third person, a doctor insincere obeisance, an act which had been beyond his control and contrary to any wish he would have had in the circumstances. As stated under Item 5, Statement of Principles on Innovative Thinking and Life Membership in the Company Employee Handbook, nothing in this document shall in any way limit the procedural rights of a member of the company as set forth in the 1940 Statement on Innovative Thinking and Life Membership, as presented by the National Association of Company Life Members. The first article of the 1940 document stated that the precise terms and conditions of every appointment must be given in writing and be in the possession of both the company and the future life member before the appointment is consummated. He argued that if the appeal committee would uphold the action to terminate his future life membership after 6 years of work on grounds unrelated to his performance, then the precise terms of the original contract could not have been properly stipulated. Why? The contract position he had held for the first two of the 6 years had only become a regular future life membership position based on evaluations which described his work as demonstrating exceptional leadership and performance. Furthermore, he had never been informed by word or in writing that his position was being funded with anything other than regular and ongoing monies. If the agreement had since become other than those stated and implied by the terms of a regular life membership slot, then he was clearly not afforded his right to precise and fair terms and, therefore, the right to renegotiate or to refuse the future life membership contract altogether. In a December meeting with underboss chief misanthrope, he had put forward the question as to how this decision to suddenly terminate him had come about. The reply was, we had to move now before our options became limited. The chief stressed, as many others already had, that it had nothing to do with his performance. In other words, as he was about to enter the very important 6-year review, assuming that once again he would receive praise for a job well done. The process of dismissing him would only become increasingly difficult in the following year, according to stipulations which did not matter in the first place. He was relieved that it had nothing to do with his performance. He then posed the following question regarding the nature of his initial Future Life membership appointment. After having served 2 exemplary years on contract to the company, what purpose was served by rehiring him at a senior administrative level, if only to terminate him precisely at the point where dismissal was believed legally possible? What purpose was served by hiring him to a regular Future Life membership position under rules which are stipulated only for temporary circus clowns? It was indeed extraordinary to hire a regular Future Life member, to require him to go through the vigorous review process year in and year out, only to terminate him because funding for his position was suddenly considered unreliable. The situation was so anomalous that it was not even covered in the company employee handbook, a point which was further emphasized by the fact that the matter had come directly to this high-level company appeal committee by default. The nature of his Future Life membership appointment was explained to him by Dr. Bendover and Taggett in a meeting he had with him in his little yellow office overwhelmed by the smell of dead composers. Dr. Taggett stated in a low voice that he would have never broached the topic of redirecting the funding for his position, that he was well aware of the agreement that he had originally made. Taggett told him, speaking in a louder voice now, that he could not now guarantee that the funding for his position would not disappear in the future. However, he said, speaking softly again, that it was his fiduciary responsibility as an underboss to state that no funding could ever be guaranteed, an announcement he was obliged to make at all times. He then mouthed in near silence to the music of Brahms that this was the purpose of the financial exigency clause in all employment contracts, whether for regular Future Life membership status or for a part-time form of spinning nickels. Therefore, I suspected the financial status of his position had in fact remained unchanged from the time of his initial employment. The funds continued to flow from the parent corporation as before. Its mandates for efficiency and general competency continued as before. Someone was telling fibs. In the top boss's December termination letter, it had been stated that he was being dismissed for financial factors and programmatic needs in the related department, a decision which had been reached in part on the recommendation of almost the doctor fuck the boss anytime, after having met with underboss Miss Meredith, a smiling sociopath, Dr. Insincere Basin, and underboss Chief Misanthrope. A record of these meetings, one between himself and almost the doctor fuck the boss anytime, was given in a letter to the top boss, sent presumably in late November. The letter gives some indication of what is meant by programmatic needs, as mentioned later in the top boss's termination letter. The letter states that his positive job reviews had only been based on a limited performance in Department A and shouldn't be given too much weight. It later states that the department is looking to fill another position, and that Dr. Insincere Basin believes the department needs someone with more breadth to fill the had always been besieged by insecurities and sinecurism, and Department A was not the exception. Furthermore, professionals everywhere were all too aware of the restrictions placed on mobility and employment once they reached a certain point in their careers. Where top-down administration was encrusted, excellence had become a code word for pedantry and nice office furniture. Small portions of invention were allowed only so as to escape the embarrassment in the company perspective. In this case, a lack of breath had neither been an issue, nor had it properly represented him to the top boss. He wanted to make that clear. The top boss's termination referred to a shift in programmatic needs within Department A. In almost the Dr. Fuck the Boss Anytime's letter of advice to the top boss, it read that underboss Miss Mary, the smiling sociopath, wanted to change the way in which the research areas were run. While he would allow his brave colleagues to address the issue of what happens when a highly specialized facility is turned over to the company goons, he decided to quote from the letter given to the top boss. Now I have been told that the research will continue under the auspices of the company goons, where its uniqueness will be lost to administrative realities and cynicism, the national recognition, the cross-company integration, the sensitivity to employee needs, and the effective research and training strategies will no longer be available to enrich the lives of our workforce. Ultimately, profit margins will be affected and returned to anemic levels of a dismal past. We had only learned recently that the so-called programmatic changes involved the establishment of discipline-specific research labs within each department of the division, while the integrated facility would effectively be dissolved when placed under the control of the company goons. This represented a major shift in attitude, for as recently as the previous spring, the division underbosses were actively resisting any move in this direction, an attitude which had been documented on several accounts. For example, in a memo to underboss Miss Mary, the smiling sociopath, from the underboss in charge, Department B, 2 years earlier, showed the objection to the establishment of ancillary research labs in Department B. brought both over to the top office and told him he could choose his favorite. This is a wonderful PR strategy for a program, and to educate the other underbosses, etc., about our unique approach to company research development. Thank you again for your leadership in this area. In a document which was issued company-wide in May, the division's research program was presented as a model of attempt to integrate research throughout the company. While he initially prepared the report as coordinator of research, but not too much innovation, please, it had been passed through underboss Miss Mary the Smiling Sociopath's office, where it was heavily edited before submission. He also wanted to mention that the company's research development awards program, which he had developed over the years, was still being used within the division, but was now being administered by Chief Misanthrope without apparent memory of its origin. In review, his dismissal letter had stated that financial factors and programmatic needs of Department A and the company required his termination, although no financial crisis had ever been uncovered. After some digging, however, he had learned that research funding had not been withdrawn because of a financial crisis, that the programmatic changes that were cited were never recommended by the task force, or by clearly defined goals and objectives defined by the division underboss. He had been told that his dismissal had nothing to do with the performance of his duties, and of course, this had been documented in the many notes of praise for his personal work and commitment to company development. His yearly reviews had been stellar. Therefore, the question as to the real purpose of his dismissal arose. The extensive educational services he had provided in Department A would be lost. The excellent and unique services of a research facility, one of the first to be established in the United States and in the world, all of its associated programs would be effectively squandered. A researcher of international reputation who was on the front line of interdisciplinary technology would be hung out to dry. He was at a loss, as were his colleagues and staff, as to the purpose of discarding a highly regarded administrator and worker at a company striving for excellence and increased profitability. No, he wasn't. He had known all along. He had adopted a power code appearance only as a means of manipulating his ideals. From the beginning, he had been keenly aware of the risks in the event his subversiveness would be discovered. And even now, he took great pleasure in knowing that he had changed hundreds of lives in the process. He had created a micro-generation of idealistic subversives over his 6 years, and they were now on the loose. With them, he had always been dead honest and out in the open. But after a few years, he had begun to recognize the hate in Miss Mary the Smiling Necrophilic's eyes when she realized that her malevolence was being used. Scary shit, that look. His only disappointment now was that he had been caught off guard, and that he would now miss life membership short of a lawsuit he had no intention of filing. The children would have to be uprooted. He would now have to disturb the narcissist's pond from somewhere outside the boat. The furniture would no longer match. Yes, indeed. He knew very well that he had been terminated because of his performance all along. Then, in a last-ditch effort at subversive unreality, he stated to the appeal committee that he did not wish to present dirty laundry, for he was hopeful that the decision to terminate him would be reversed based on the evidence. After all, he did not believe that the groundwork for a productive relationship in the future would be helped in this way. In spite of it all, however, he was obliged to clear up one more point which had been stated in writing by the top boss concerning his so-called refusal to communicate with the underboss, Miss Mary, the smiling sociopath. As his brave life member colleagues would attest to, an unwillingness to communicate professionally or socially had never been one of his traits. However, as stated in the Bill of Rights and Responsibilities, under Article 2.8.1 of the Company Employee Handbook, members of the company who have substantial authority have an especially strong obligation to maintain an environment conducive to respect for the rights of others, to the fulfillment of their responsibilities. It goes on to say that bosses and underbosses have a particular responsibility to protect their workers from unwarranted external and internal attacks. He explained that within these guidelines, he would always be available for open and trustworthy communication with the bosses, underbosses, and anyone else. Silly boy.
Thank you.
Horror movies are there to keep you from where the evil is, neat and clean and orderly and law-abiding and prompt and proper. Friendly, even cute, comes tidy. Is helpful and courteous, righteous and kind, courageous in line, so caring while glaring, and sharing the love of an echo, heroic.
Thank you. Saturday, June 11, 1994.
Just woke up.
On National Public Radio early this morning, I learned that 250 years ago today, Johann Sebastian Bach played music never before heard to address an audience on a magnificent church organ, and that just 50 years ago today, Allied forces leveled the same church along with the rest of the city. All of this was reported in the context of IBM's recent decision to finance the construction of a virtual rendition of this church, which would allow one to roam freely through the old church via a computer monitoring system. The report said that the only existing color photos of the church were ordered by Adolf Hitler just prior to the war. Yesterday, while taking Francis for a stroll in her baby carriage, I came across the crew of sweaty young men noisily heaving broken roof tiles onto an old truck. There was dust and rubble everywhere. As we carefully approached the site, I noticed a man with crossed arms watching the workmen with a mixed look of satisfaction and concern on his face. When he noticed us, he smiled and came over, and after waiting for the noise to ease off a bit, he told me that he had put on the previous roof by himself over 20 years ago when he was just 36. I said I was 43, that I had put on a roof of about the same square footage just recently, and that roofing was definitely young man's work. He agreed and then asked me what I thought it was costing him to have this one put on. I guessed it to the dollar. Impressed, he introduced himself with a strong handshake, saying his name was Jerry Bach. And as he spoke, the letters B-O-C-K flashed before my eyes. After introducing myself and a near-sleeping Francis,
I verified the spelling of his name by speaking the letters back to him.
B-O-C-K.
He said that I was right and that most people wanted to spell it B-A-C-H. We chatted a while longer, and then as we strolled on, I wondered why, of all people, I would immediately think of the B-O-C-K spelling. I suppose he reminded me of a childhood friend with a similar name, of a time not long after the Dresden rubble, of a time before I knew who J.S. Bach was. While leaving a concert at the Canberra School of Art in Australia, which featured the music of Australia's greatest avant-garde composer, I overheard a modern-looking couple sigh and then say the concert hadn't been so bad after all, that they had expected to be angry when it was all over. It was my impression that they had attended the event only to be seen, and they had been apprehensive about sitting in a room surrounded by sounds and people they could not relate to. To their relief, however, they had survived and were leaving blissfully with every strand of their musical prejudices perfectly in place. As I walked just behind them to the parking lot, in a haze of moral superiority, I editorialized that not only had the composer succeeded in pleasing his modern audience, he had effectively ramped his left unconsciousness to speeds and intensities. At a party after the concert, I asked the composer what his children did for a living, and he said that his daughter was a housewife and that his son was a tattoo artist.
You're a prick.
I said my daughters were both angels and that my son was in a sparring chair. Sensing my play, he said that he wasn't a judgmental person. Rising just out of reach to a position in the clouds, I replied that we are all very judgmental, even those of us who say we are not. The difference being that we judge according to different values. That what makes us all the same is that we are first and foremost confusing. And that what makes us unique is the way we react to an initial assessment, what we usually refer to as first impression. Entering a trance-like state now, I said that when we encounter people or even art for the first time, the most basic and essential question is, how free are you? Are your thoughts your own? Now, I would agree that we vary in our abilities to detect freedom in others, but whatever the reading, our immediate reaction is the first critical step in establishing the complex web of our assessment, all of which is based on whether we believe freedom is good or bad, whether this person's clear thinking is advantageous or dangerous. For example, I have known those, even within the world of contemporary art, who do not believe that innovation is even possible. That it has all been said or done before. That innovators are basically sham artists or insane people. That this so-called clear thinking is something to be wary of, and something which is potentially dangerous. As I worked in my garden pulling weeds, my 12-year-old daughter announced from the garden wall that she had a book due at the library and wondered whether I would give her a lift over in the car. I replied that the weather was nice and that she could take her new bike. She said it had a flat tire.
Yeah, right.
I said that she could take her old little bike, which was still in good working order. At my suggestion, her arms recoiled involuntarily upwards.
I was shocked.
Her head jolted and strained to one side, and a look of terror filled her eyes.
What?
What? While I was surprised by her reaction, I soon realized what had just happened. She had been stunned by the absolute knowledge of what happens to kids who break certain unwritten social rules. There was a chance that a classmate might see her riding this little kid bicycle, and the ridicule that would result was not worth risking. The price was simply too high to pay. What I had witnessed in my daughter was the palpable energy force of a society that fancies a form of freedom on the one hand, but viciously punishes unusual behavior and thought on the other. Over the years, my daughter had gone from a spontaneous and sophisticated
sophisticated artist without boundaries or concern for specialization, one who described her drawings in gestures and vague color descriptions, to an obsessed drawer of horses with increasing instances of writer's block. And Elian was in better shape than I was at age 12. As it happens, we live in a world where the avant-garde music of other times is performed by well-paid musicians who do not perform the avant-garde music of this time. Delightful daughter was playing the piano for me in the living room as her mother was doing the washing up just round the corner. Zoe, who had just turned 8, announced cheerfully that she had composed the song for me, and she immediately began playing a tune with a mildly dissonant chord in the left hand, accompanied by a pretty melody in the right. Within seconds, her mother called out for her to move the little finger in the left hand down a semitone to the C, and the middle finger up a semitone to the E. Zoe replied, "But it's my song, Mama. I'm making it up." Undeterred, and ever so patiently, the good mother called out once again, and then again, until Zoe shifted her little fingers to the more cheerful C major chord. After all, her mama thought, there was a chance that someone from her school might hear her playing the diminished chord. The ridicule was simply not worth risking. In the corner of the room, there was a smiley face posted on a door with the inscription, "Just say no to drugs." I mentioned to her mother that the smiley face had been invented by some guy who had run for mayor in Seattle. We live in a world of music where, for example, university jazz departments exist to teach the innovations of African American inventors who, if they could magically apply to these programs, would not be allowed entry. They would be considered musically illiterate, unteachable, and lacking in excellence. Martha and Jack visited friends while in graduate school, and as they entered their friend's apartment, they were met by shelves and shelves of books. Martha couldn't believe her eyes and cheerfully exclaimed that they needed to get some of these for their dining room. Jack agreed. As John watched television, he saw suffering and cruelty everywhere. It touched him so that in time he became increasingly desperate to show others that he cared, and being an artist, he believed that he could do this best through his paintings. He thought that if he could display suffering in graphic detail, others would see it as he did and take steps to make things better. Denise and I were watching television, and toward the end of the nightly news, a human interest story showed a home video of an old woman rescuing a stranded and terrified child from a drainage ditch after a sudden downpour in California. As the heavy, unkempt woman strained beyond her capacity to save the child while risking her own life, I was enveloped by a sudden flush of emotion which I fought desperately to contain. If I had glanced at my wife and saw her in a similar state, I would have become emotionally untied. I could have easily wept aloud. In a few minutes, however, I regained control, and without looking, I asked Denise whether she had felt a similar flush. She was still unable to reply. Since childhood, I had often experienced moments like these, but it was only recently that I had come to consider the cause. I wondered why they were so intense and what caused them. Whether everyone had them. I clearly remember my mother and father tearing up in similar situations. So, out of curiosity, I began asking others if they experienced these spontaneous flushes and concluded that they were very common. Even so, no one seemed to have a clue as to what caused them. It was only recently, while reading Erich Fromm's Escape from Freedom, that I associated these moments with the sudden and spontaneous coming into oneness that Fromm often refers to. The connection was useful to me in communication as a personal experience common to others and one which could be specifically pointed to. It was the actual substance of all that gibberish that gets bantered about by those who replace their experience with a substance. With an experience which is less common and more mystical. As we watched the human interest story, the emotional flush seemed to be the empathetic merging of our identities with that of the old woman and the helpless child. It was the essence of Charles Ives' Wonder of a Moment paragraph, which had similarly touched me when I first read his essays before a sonata 20 years earlier. For a period of time, I was obsessed by the writings of Primo Levi, an Italian chemist who had survived Auschwitz because of a knowledge of chemicals which would nourish him. After the war, he again worked as a chemist, and in his spare time, he wrote splendid accounts of workmen as they labored in various trades throughout the ages. In one of his later books, he wrote that, after the war, he found himself judging others according to whether he believed they would have hidden him from Hitler. After reading this, I too started to consider relationships along these lines and came to believe that categorical groupings of people seem to have little impact on the percentage of those I believe willing to put their lives on the line for someone else. Having been raised in a family with a father who once belonged to the John Birch Society, I knew for certain there were those who were nominal racists who, when directly confronted with the actual face of their enemy, would switch sides in a moment. Later on, having been liberally educated at the best of American art school, I knew for certain that there were nominal free thinkers who likewise would have switched sides. In an alienated existence, personal experience is replaced by the remarkable experiences of others. So John made his paintings, and they sold and reviewed well, and many patrons made a point of telling him that they were touched by the suffering, and he felt better about it all, and thought that it had been worth the months and months of work, and now, at long last, he could take a break and feel at ease with himself, and beneath it all he knew he was not moved, for what he had painted was not true for him, and therefore could not be true for others. Had he engineered a fraud? Had his audience been insincere? Probably not. I believe John did his sincere best, as did his patrons. Yes, they wanted desperately to feel the suffering, but like my 12-year-old daughter, the best John could do was to shop at the local New Age store with socially conscious ideas for a sad face. As I pulled out of their parking lot, I happened upon a sight which jolted me into the present. About 50 yards up the street and around the corner, I witnessed a small girl wearing a backpack running and screaming as a German shepherd barked and nipped viciously at her sides. The child was running hysterically into the street, which was usually jammed with traffic. Turning onto the street from the opposite direction, my reaction was to drive across the open lanes in hopes of cherry-picking the dog from the child's side. I would have killed the dog in an instant and without remorse. At that very moment, however, the dog left her side, and as it sauntered cheerfully back to its hiding place, I spied its owner standing behind a screen door on his back porch. The little girl continued her frantic escape as she veered up a drive and disappeared behind a pump at a nearby gas station. Even without a rigorous disassembly of John's paintings and intentions, whether or not we say so, whether or not we have the awareness or language to voice a deeper knowing, or whether or not our social setting will even allow us to be truthful, what we sense is the distance, the alienation, and the abstractness of the experience for the artist. In this way, we are untouched. We remain the same. We are moved by what is true. As a group of us were milling around outside the Merlino Art Center, I noticed two youths without shirts sauntering up the street. I noticed their dusty bodies and disheveled hair, and that they were walking with a menacing swagger. As we chatted about the future of the arts in Tacoma, I watched as a car filled with teenagers crept by the two, who responded with name-calling and fist-like gestures. After the car passed, the now animated youth started to move down the street in the direction of our group. Though they seemed to be only half aware of our presence, I mentioned to the group that we should be conscious of a potential situation here, but the discussion was so gossipy and tense it carried on indifferently. As the young man drew close to us, the car filled with what was probably rival gang members suddenly came screeching round the opposite corner at a high speed and came racing directly at us. In the flurry that followed, one of our group, a muscular former gang member from the Bronx, quickly opened the door of the art center and yelled for us to enter. All but one of the group, a Catholic sister, if you can believe it, ran inside, where I immediately leaped to the side and out of the trajectory of bullets I was certain would soon be flying. At this very moment, I keenly remember thinking that I had absolutely no concern for the lives of anyone else in the group. I was out to protect my own ass. As I lay flattened against the wall behind a marble support, I watched as our former gang member attempted to keep one of the youths from entering the building. He had the boy's arm pinned in the door, and I thought for a moment that if he wanted to, he could have easily sheared it off. After a bit, however, he relented and let the terrified and angry and pleading teenager into the building. At this, the rest of us, minus the dazed and white nun who was now turning in circles like a wedding cake bride just outside the glass doors, started to creep wide-eyed up the steps further into the old building, looking for a place to hide. As we moved, we found a gallery area where we locked the door and pulled the shades tight. We knew, of course, that at least one of the gang members was in the building, and that the potential for a horrific episode was very possible. There was a telephone in the space, and our weightlifter friend called the police in a whispered voice. After 20 minutes or so, we eased open a side window just in time to watch a squad car driving by slowly on the street below. All seemed calm, so we decided to take our chances and leave the building. As we departed, we found the sun shining, our wedding cake acquaintances cheerful as ever, wondering what had happened to us all.